often wondered what it was like for her when she entered Glory to get her eyesight back. It would have been something to be blind all those years and then to die and wake up and see Jesus first thing. Ready? Yeah. All right, if you would, turn to Numbers, chapter 13. And I've been thinking all week on what to preach this morning and kind of getting my thoughts together and been wanting for some time to preach more of some of the stories in the Old Testament. Not sure why, but the Lord led me to this one on the 12 men that the Lord had Moses send out to the Promised Land before Israel entered the Promised Land, of course. The Bible tells us they went there to spy it out. It means they went to check on things, to see how things were, if you will read this chapter, but if you notice, they didn't interact with anybody there in the Promised Land, so they truly did spy it out. They were good spies. As far as we know, they went there and back undetected by the inhabitants of the land. But they saw lots of things while they were there. Some good, some bad. And we'll talk about those things this morning. I don't know. It's not going to be I'm not planning on this being a series or anything, but I think the next few weeks we'll look at some different stories in the Old Testament. Some of them, I guess all of them are really going to pertain to us. You know, they're lessons for us. That's what they're there for. They're not... The promises that God made these people are not promises for the church, like some try to teach. They were promises for Israel. We'll see that this morning in this story. In their day, most of them believed that it was a promise that was going to happen in their day. But it didn't. You know, if you read the rest of the story, especially going to Joshua, where the book of Joshua, where they went into the land finally, they never took the whole of the Promised Land, ever. They will one day. That's in the future. They were supposed to, but they didn't. They disobeyed the Lord in that matter and didn't finish the job that he gave them. But we're not going to get into that this morning, maybe another time. I'm not going to, when we get through verses 4 through 15, I'm not going to try to pronounce all these names. There's going to be a few that we're going to concentrate on because they are talked about more than the others. So let's start with verse 1. Numbers chapter 13, verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Send thou men that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel, of every tribe of their fathers, shall ye send a man, every one a ruler among them. Now, let's go ahead and read verse 3. And Moses, by the commandment of the Lord, sent them from the wilderness of Paran. All those men were heads of the children of Israel. So he was to take one man from each tribe. There were 12 tribes, remember. Take one man from each tribe, and not just any man. He's to be a ruler. In other words, a leader. It says heads of the children of Israel there. So these were men of renown in their own tribes. They were the leaders in their tribes. As we'll see in a moment, at least two of them were young men. Caleb and Joshua were fairly young men at the time. We don't know how old, But they were, they would be in the group that would later enter the promised land many years later. Remember, they would disobey God again and not go in when he told them to, and out of fear. And God told them, okay, you're not going to ever enter the promised land. You're going to die out in the wilderness. The adults, that's what he told them, it'll be your children and your grandchildren that will enter. Caleb and Joshua were among that group. Joshua, remember, takes the place of Moses later on. So if you read down through these names, you see the names of the men who were going to go on this journey, on this spy adventure. Tells who their fathers were. Why does it do that? Well, I believe if we were Jews, it would be because we would probably know who those men were. They were men of renown in their day. As Gentiles, we don't know much about all that. We don't study Jewish lineage other than what we see in the Bible. So we won't get into any of that. If you notice, verse 6 of the tribe of Judah, what's significant about that? Well, the tribe of Judah would be the ones that would possess the part of the land eventually where Jerusalem would be. Remember the split kingdom after Solomon was Israel and Judah. Caleb is mentioned there in verse 6. Caleb would be the man who would lead out of that tribe. If you go down to verse 8, the tribe of Ephraim, Oshea, the son of Nun, and we'll see later on where Moses changed his name to Joshua, the son of Nun, and there's all kinds of jokes you can make about the son of Nun, but we won't go there this morning. His father's name was Nun, okay? He wasn't an orphan. But then you see some other names that are popular down through there, Manasseh, some Dan, the tribes. He mentions the tribes there. And like I said, we're not going to go into all those, but if you skip down to verse 16, these are the names of the men which Moses sent to spy out the land. And Moses called Oshea, the son of Nun, Jehoshua. And later on in the next chapter, you see it's shortened to Joshua. Oshea, a good Irish name, huh? And it got changed to Joshua. So Moses sent these men to spy out the land. Why? To see what was over there. Did Moses do this on his own? No. God told him to, remember? And oftentimes we think, well, this was just a weakness on the side of Moses that he sent these men over there because he was afraid of what was there. No. God told him to. If you remember back in the first few verses, verse 1 says, and the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, send thou men, that they may search the land of Canaan. God commanded Moses. So this was a command from God. Now in verse 17, and Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, and said unto them, get you up this way southward, and go up into the mountain, and see the land, what it is, and the people that dwelleth therein, whether they be strong or weak, few or many, and what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities they be that they dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds, and what the land is, whether it be fat or lean, whether there be wood therein or not, and be ye of good courage, and bring of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. In other words, it was harvest time for grapes. So Moses tells them, go check it out. Check out the people. What kind of people are living there? Why did he want to know that? Well, for one, are they heathen? They probably knew or had a pretty good idea that they were. Were they a heathen people? Were they pagans? Were they godly people? Remember, Abraham had sojourned in this land at one time. And so were there descendants of Abraham still there? Well, not of the line of Isaac. Remember, the line of Isaac all migrated to Egypt eventually. And that's where the people that's with Moses at this time, that's where they came from. Now, it's very possible that the ones that were possessing Canaan at this time could have been of his illegitimate son, Ishmael. So that could have been some of his descendants. Being in the land of Canaan, we know that Noah had a grandson named Canaan. His son Ham had a son named Canaan. And some say that that's where they settled. So they would have been, they would not have been a godly people if that was the case. Moses said, "See the land, what it is, and the people that dwelleth therein, whether they be strong or weak, few or many." Are they a military people? Are they a fighting people? Are they weak? Are they peaceful? What are they? And then, what is the land that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad? In other words, how is it for crops? You know, can we grow stuff? If we take it, are we going to be able to grow crops there? Is it fertile? And remember, I don't know, we did a study a few years ago on that part of the world. Where this takes place is at the southern end of the Fertile Crescent. And so it wasn't very, at that time in the world, it was a very fertile place. Not so much. Well, it's becoming more fertile now because the people of Israel who are there now are making it so. They begin to rehabilitate the land and they're beginning to grow things there again. But for many generations after the captivity in Nebuchadnezzar's day, the land of Israel was a barren place. It was a pile of rocks. That's all it was, because remember, Nebuchadnezzar's army went in and destroyed everything. And that was the practice back then. But in Moses' day, it was a very fertile place. Moses wanted to know, what about the cities they live in? Why? Well, remember, God had told them that they were going to go in and they were going to possess not only possess this land, but possess even these cities. He wanted to know, what kind of cities do they live in? Do they have fortified cities that are going to be easy to defend if we do move in? Is there other things that we need to know about the cities? And he says, do they live in tents or strongholds? Do they live in walled cities? Or are they nomads? Well, there was some of both there. If you remember the whole story throughout the Exodus there, after the Exodus there, when Joshua went in, there was some of both. There were nomads and there were strong walled cities there. Remember, the city of Jericho was a walled city. There were others. And what the land is, whether it be fat or lean, you know, are they growing crops? Is there forest there so that we can build homes and whatever? And he says, be ye of good courage. In other words, be brave. Don't worry about what's there. Go look and see what's there. And bring us back some of the fruit of the land. Let's see what's there. Bring it back to us as a witness to what's there. And it was the perfect time, because it was the time of the grape harvest. So that they would have been about to harvest the grapes, and Moses would have wanted to know, you know, what kind of grapes do they grow there? What are they? Are they good for eating, for wine, whatever they use it for? And in verse 21, so they went up and searched the land from the wilderness of Zin unto Rehob, as men come to Hamath And they ascended by the south and came unto Hebron, where Amon and Sheshai and Talmai, the children of Anak, were. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. And there's all kinds of stories here we could chase. These children of Anak supposedly were giants. Or some say a race of giants. They weren't a race. They were just giants. They were bigger than most men. We see that down throughout history. There's certain, for whatever genetic reason, some families grow taller and bigger than others. And this man Anak was known for that. His family were large people. Hebron, it says, was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Zoan was one of the oldest cities in Egypt, if not the oldest. So Hebron was built before then. 7 years, it says, before then. Some say that Hebron was built by Ham for his son Canaan. I don't know how you figure that out, but that's historical data. Verse 23, and they came unto the brook of Ishcol and cut down from thence a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they bare it between two upon a staff, and they brought of the pomegranates and of the figs. So we commonly hear in this story, they bought this big bunch of grapes. And if you ever see some of the popular Sunday school literature, they'll show these two guys carrying a bunch of grapes on a branch between them. It wasn't just grapes that they brought. They brought a little bit of everything. It just so that the grapes were so large, it took two men to carry them. And then they brought other pieces. They brought pomegranates and figs. And he doesn't mention how big the pomegranates and figs were, does he? He just says that's what they brought. The place was called the Brook of Ishcol because of the cluster of grapes which the children of Israel cut down from thence. You notice the children, we don't know what the name of the brook was before. These men, these 12 men that went there and found these fruits there, these cluster of grapes, they named the brook. Now, isn't that a common thing? Even today when a nation, not so much today, but in modern times anyway, even when a nation goes in and takes over another nation, oftentimes they'll change the names of landmarks. Didn't our forefathers do the same thing when they came to this country? The Native Americans had names for landmarks, and the white man come in and changed all the names, or a lot of them, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them. That was a common practice. And they turned from searching of the land after 40 days. They were there 40 days. That's a long time. And they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel under the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh, and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him and said, we came unto the land whither thou sendest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. There's plenty there. We got nothing to worry about. Nevertheless, the people, be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. Like I said, Anak was world-renowned in his day. The children of Israel knew who he was. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and by the coast of Jordan. All names that would later give Israel fits throughout their whole existence in the promised land. These other nations, you can go all the way down to the prophets, to Ezekiel and Daniel, Jeremiah. They talk about these same nations, how that they gave Israel fits. You know, they sided with Nebuchadnezzar when he came and overthrew Jerusalem. But then, as payback, God took care of them later with the same army. And Caleb stilled the people before Moses. In other words, he said, hey, y'all settle down. It's not as bad, you know, as these guys are making it out to be. And if you didn't read this in its context, if you didn't go through and read the next chapter, and I don't know that we'll get to the next chapter today, but you see Caleb mentioned here, but nobody else. But if you go to the next chapter, you see Joshua was there standing with Caleb. And those two men boldly stood before the congregation and preached the truth. They fully understood the promise of God. Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. He had been there as a witness. He saw what the rest of the 12 had seen. But in verse 31, it says, but the men that went up with him said, we be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. But what was the difference? Israel had God. And that's what Caleb was getting at. God's promised us this land. There's nothing to stop us from taking it. And they brought up an evil report of the land, which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, the land which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and we were in their sight. So there's these giants in the land that they're afraid of. They build this story up. Here's all the reasons why we can't go in and take the land. Never mentioning God, do they? But Caleb and Joshua. In this story from the Old Testament, we read of a common problem with God's people throughout all the ages. Not just in Moses' day. This is a problem with God's people throughout all ages, all the way down to today, and will continue to be until the Lord comes again. It's a lack of faith in God. The people of Israel had been freed from bondage in Egypt. And remember, they had seen all the miracles that God had worked. While they were in Egypt, afterwards, they had heard all their lives the preaching and the teaching of what he had done with Abraham. All the way back, they knew their lineage, they knew their background, and they knew what had happened from Abraham all the way to Joseph, and then now with Moses. And yet they still doubted God. And don't we do the same today? They had been freed from Egypt, and God had provided their very need and protected them all along their long journey to the promised land. Up until this point, God had provided everything they needed. They didn't like it oftentimes. They didn't like the manna. It wasn't seasoned right for them. But he provided what they needed to eat. Manna and doves. He provided them water when they needed water. He saved them from the Egyptian army by opening up the Red Sea and letting them walk across on dry land. Unlike the movies where they show them wading through mud, it was dry land, is what the Bible says. They had seen Moses come down from the mountain, and his face shone so brightly they had to put a hood over his head so it didn't blind him after he saw just the hinder parts of God. Moses had brought them the Ten Commandments. He had brought them the rest of the law that God had had given to them. All the miracles that God had performed or had used men to perform, Moses and Aaron and others. And now they've reached the promised land, the land that God has promised them. You've got, at least at the beginning of the story, the 12 men that come back tell about this wondrous place. All and they bring back fruit and the fruit of the land and show to them what's there. But only two of them stand on the side of God. The other 10 tell the horrors of what's there. And don't we oftentimes hear that today? You know, God's people, we sit and watch the news on TV and we look, look how bad it is out there. And it is. It's truly bad. But where's our faith? Hasn't God provided for us? Even if we're the poorest of the poor, He still provided for us. The land God has promised their father Abraham would be given to his seed. They knew this story inside and out. They'd been taught it all their lives, for many generations, that the promised land that Moses was taking them to was the land that God had promised to Abraham and his seed. Through all the miracles God performed before and during this journey, they still doubted. Something we don't think about much is, what about their clothing? Remember, and I've heard this preached on before, you know, their shoes didn't wear out. They walked around for 40 years. The first bunch of them did for 40 years. There's no talk of having to resole their shoes. They wore the same clothes, maybe except for maybe the kids that as they grew, they had to have bigger clothes, I guess. They had the perfect diet. You know, I've heard in the past men try to take the diet that they had in the Exodus and try to say that that's what we need to be eating today. The New Testament tells us different than that. He tells us all things are good for us. But there was a reason for that diet. That's why it was good for them. And would it be good for us today? Certainly, it probably would be. It's not commanded to us, though, like it was to them. But God had a reason for that. Not just that they obey what He said, but it was also a good diet for them because of them traveling in the desert. I've heard Christian doctors talk about how the things that God told them not to eat, that if you were traveling in the desert, you wouldn't want to eat that stuff because it wouldn't be good for you. The things that God told them to eat was the perfect diet for someone that was in their situation. It makes sense. But they still doubted God. Here in this chapter, they are at the boundary of the promised land. God instructs Moses to send one man from each tribe to spy out the land. Not just any man from each tribe. God told Moses to send men who were rulers, men who were in leadership and trusted by their tribe. And Moses does that. Why did he pick the rulers? So that people would believe him. He picked the most trustworthy men from each tribe. And that's who he sent. He didn't send, or at least in the beginning, he didn't send men who would most likely come back and stir up trouble. He wanted men that they trusted. Two men of these 12 came back with a good report. It was truly the land of milk and honey that God promised them. But then the other 10 spoke otherwise. They told the giants in the land and how impossible it would be for the children of Israel to conquer the people living in the land. They scared them. They used scare tactics to put doubts in their minds of what God had promised. Remember, God had promised them they were going to overtake these people. All throughout the Exodus, Moses and Aaron were relaying to them what God was telling them about how things were going to happen. They were going to go to the promised land, and they were going to annihilate everybody there. And it was all going to be at the hand of God. There was nothing for them to fear until these 10 men came back and told them otherwise. And they trusted man rather than trusting God. And like I said, isn't that what we do today? You know, we've had this train wreck in Ohio, further up the river from where we're at. And yeah, it's a bad thing. I'm not doubting that. Our government appears to be hiding some things there, especially how bad it really is. We don't know how bad it really is. We hear reports on both sides. We hear that some of the spill is working its way down the Ohio River and may enter our water supply. Do we worry about that? We should be concerned about it. Don't get me wrong. But God's going to take care of it. We may all die from it. You know, we don't know. If we do, we'd be better off. You know, so what's to worry about? But I think the worry, our worry should be, people think about the immediate, and they worry about what's going to happen to me. We should be worried about what's going to happen to the future generations. And we see these things that happen, and then our government tries to hide, or maybe they don't tell the whole story about. It may not affect us, or it maybe not affect us immediately. But if the Lord doesn't come back soon, it may affect our future generations. That's what we should be concerned about. Who did the congregation of Israel listen to? They listened to man instead of God. And isn't that the way we are today? That's what we've been talking about. We listen to the bad news and forsake the good news. What's the good news? The gospel. We worry about what's going on in the world instead of paying attention to the gospel. The good news. God's people have always paid more attention to the stories of gloom, doom and gloom, more than the promises of God, haven't they? God's people being guilty of that since the beginning. Today we watch the news on TV and we think, oh no, the world's coming to an end. Well, if it does, so what? Before it comes to an end, we'll be gone. The price of our necessities are on the rise. You know, we worry about the price of eggs and the price of bread and gas and whatever else. Things that we need to sustain life while we live here. Price of medications are going up all the time. We act surprised about those things. We shouldn't. That's the way of the world. What did God promise his children? What did he promise us? That he'd take care of us. It doesn't matter how high the price of our food gets. He's still going to take care of us. Maybe may come a day where we have to quit eating as much. Maybe that's his plan, you know. We don't know. He promised to provide for us. And he promised us peace in this life. But there are stipulations to his promises. Even in Moses' day, there was a stipulation to his promise. And the stipulation is to receive the promises of God, we must be faithful and follow him. That doesn't mean that he doesn't fulfill the promise. That means that if we want to receive the promises of God, we have to follow him. These people in Israel, or these people of Israel, again, I'm not going to go into the next chapter. I've thought about it, but it's going to be too much time. But if you go on and read chapter 14, you see where they didn't follow the Lord and do what he said, and what did God do? He put them back out in the wilderness for another 40 years. Why? So that the generation that had denied him and that had doubted him would die off. And if you notice, let's see. The 10 men, I can't remember where it's at now, in chapter 14, but the 10 men that came back and brought back the bad news, they were the first ones to die. Caleb and Joshua lived and went on to see the promised land and see Israel take the promised land. But the other 10, they were among the first ones to die when they went back into the wilderness. Why? Did that mean that God's promise wasn't good for them? No, God keeps his promises, but like I said, there are stipulations. They didn't do what God told them to do. God took their lives. The same way with the whole generation. There was a whole generation of the people of Israel who would die off, and it would be their children and grandchildren that would take the land eventually under the leadership of Joshua and Caleb. Do we see the correlation between God's people in the Old Testament and in us today? We should. You know, there's men that will preach that, well, we have nothing to do with the Old Testament. You know, the laws doesn't apply to us and none of this. There's men that actually will tell you that it's a waste of time to read stories in the Old Testament. That's foolishness. They're there for a reason. God put them there for a reason. They're for us to learn. To learn from. We don't have the same promises that Israel had. There are things like this story and other stories like it in the Old Testament that can pertain to us because of our lack of faithfulness in the Lord. And we should go back and read these stories often. Remember what Paul told Timothy to remind the brethren? These are the things he was talking about. Remind the brethren of these things. Why? So we don't make the same mistakes. God promised Israel a land of milk and honey. The people in Moses' day thought God owed it to them. That was one of their problems, was pride. That they left Egypt with prideful. They thought, boy, God's going to give us the best that we could ever have on this earth. And it took them 40 years to get there, and they began to complain and to grumble right away. Remember, first thing after they crossed the Red Sea, what'd they do? Moses went up on the mountain to meet with God, and he comes back, and they're worshiping golden calves. And the high priest Aaron had a part in it. He tried to deny it later, but God tells us different in his word. He played along with it. They grumbled and complained. They didn't have the garlic and the leeks they'd had in Egypt. They didn't have, even though they were in bondage and slaves, there were comforts that they had back in Egypt that they didn't have in the wilderness. And we don't have any idea what all those comforts were, but you can imagine. You know, they didn't have a house to live in. They were living in tents or out in the open, one of the two. Having to constantly walk everywhere they went, you know, at long distances. I'm sure at some point the guy walking next to you didn't smell as good as he did when he first started out, you know. I'm sure they went long periods of time without a bath. There's all kinds of things that they grumbled about. And they, as time went on, the more doubts entered their minds. Is God really going to take us? Did he just bring us out here to kill us? That's humanly thinking. That's natural thinking is, okay, we've been in on this journey for 40 years. Are we really going to get there? It's not that far. If you look on a map, I don't bring the map over here this morning, but if you look on the map of that area, it's even walking. It's not a 40-year journey. God took them around the long way to teach them a lesson. And many of them didn't catch the lesson. In chapter 14, as we said, God told Moses he would not let those who doubted into the land, but rather it would be their children. They had scoffed at God and doubted his promise, even after witnessing all the miracles he performed for them during their journey. And you look at us today. Look at the miracles that God has performed. In his word, we read in the Old Testament and the New Testament, both miracles he performed. What about in our own lives? He gives us breath to live every day, doesn't he? That's a miracle within itself. We think it's a small thing. Well, no, it's not. Most of us can get out of bed on our own in the morning and go do what we want to do. There's so many. And then just our salvation. Look at the miracles. There's multiple miracles involved in that. And how ungrateful we are, even for that. Today we read of these stories in the Old Testament. We see the promises God made to his people back then. We see all the miracles he performed for their benefit. Who does God do miracles for? It's for the benefit of his people. Or sometimes he did miracles, we know in the Old Testament and some in the New Testament, where miracles were performed to show the heathen who God really was. That happened too. But for the most part, God's miracles and his promises are for the benefit of his people. We see his mercy on them as they complained over and over again when things didn't go the way they thought they should. And do we not do the same today? How much complaining do we do every day? Knowing that God's promised us to take care of us, and yet we complain constantly. Have we not learned from the lessons God teaches in his word? That's why we go back to the Old Testament and study it some, because there are lessons there that we need to learn. There's things that we need to be reminded of. Remember, those stories are in our Bibles for our benefit, not for the benefit of the unsaved world. They're for our benefit, God's people, and especially his churches. You know, I've often heard it said, and I believe it, that the Bible is a Baptist book. It's written to his churches. And yet, oftentimes his churches are the biggest doubters of all of the people, all of his elect. Remember these things. I'd encourage you to go and read chapter 14 and see what's there. There's a lot more to the story. Like I said, we'll see what the Lord has, but at least in my mind, I'm thinking the next few weeks we're going to look at some other stories in the Old Testament. I don't know what's next. We'll see what the Lord has. There's a lot there that we could look at. We're not going to look at all of them, of course, but things that pertained not only to God's people in that day, but also for us today. Lessons we need to learn. So we'll stop there for this morning.